Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people have impressed me more with their understanding of and mastery of many of the details involving that war for the free world than our first guest for today's show. His name is Kevin Freeman. He's no stranger to our microphones, and I hope to our audience as well, both for his weekly appearances here, but also for the terrific job he does at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, which you can find on Blaze TV and learn more about it, economicwarroom.com. Kevin is the author of two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and a very, very active contributor to the public policy debate, among other places, at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, it's good to have you with us. Join us each week as you do is definitely one of the high points of this program.
Well, thank you, Frank. That's an honor.
Let me ask you first and foremost to talk a little bit about your program, Kevin. Most days we at least touch on it, but you've had a very, I think, important guest recently in the person of Dr. Ben Carson, a man who I have come to admire tremendously for his accomplishments in so many different fields, from medicine to public policy to philanthropy and healthcare and so on. Talk, if you would, a little bit about his current role and the showcasing of it that you've done on your program lately.
Certainly. Well, Dr. Carson's become a friend. I've always admired him. He's one of the brightest minds, not only in medicine, but also in politics and the human experience. I mean, he shares wisdom in such a compelling way. In fact, we had him in our studio, and Frank, you were a part of that, where we just vision cast about how do we save America. And we shared six action steps that people could do. We called it the new Operation Dynamo. It's named after Churchill's Operation Dynamo that really rescued the men from Dunkirk. And the six steps are begin with prayer. Dr. Carson is a deep man of faith. He really, I see it in his life. You can get it from his wife when you talk with Ben and Candy together. It really is an important part of his life. Here's how you take a person of no means at all. His mother was cleaning houses for a living and couldn't read. And bring out of them a rocket scientist, which is Dr. Carson's brother, and a brain surgeon, Dr. Carson.
So world-class brain surgeon at that, yeah. And a young boy who was headed for a very different outcome, but for that mother. It's an extraordinary personal story. So the other six, if you could quickly
begin with prayer. Get educated, which we recommend you watch Economic War Room every week. Find a trained financial advisor. That's the third one. Weaponize your spending and your giving. And we talked about how you could change your spending habits to support America and the values that we share and your giving. American Cornerstone Institute is Dr. Carson's new program, which is, we talked about new wineskins for new wine, because the world has changed. We can't put our money in the same old charities. We have to find new places to do our giving. And that's the fifth step. And number six is expect a miracle. And it was a magical evening. We filmed it all and we shared it all. And you can find that via economicwarroom.com.
I was very proud to be there, and I think the team, it was not just Ben, of course, you were involved, and there was another person, as I recall, who was also given a speaking part. Remind me who that was.
That was Glenn Story from Patriot Mobile.
Ah, yes, Glenn Story, good friend, and corporate leader in the telecommunications space, Patriot Mobile, a tremendous brand and a great conservative leader in his own right. Let me ask you, Kevin, speaking of weaponizing your money and choosing your financial advisor for that purpose, there was a very interesting development this week. I mean, almost entirely out of character with an administration that has, as we'll be talking about with Victoria Coates shortly, really seemingly thrown in with the Chinese Communist Party on so many different topics. But they have, on the basis of crimes against humanity, taken some steps that are promising, I think, when it comes to preventing our further underwriting of a regime that perpetrates things like genocide and other horrors against its own people and what it intends to do to the rest of us as well. Talk a little bit about these human rights sanctions that have now been imposed and the warning coming out of the State Department and other government agencies that ought to really shiver the timbers, as they say, of corporate executives that are intent on doing business with the Chinese Communist Party and financiers that are only too happy to help bankroll their malevolence.
Well, it really is remarkable. The same State Department that before the Trump administration overlooked every Chinese atrocity, these things have been going on, including human organ harvesting and so forth, for quite some time. But they did issue a warning to Wall Street, and they issued sanctions on these Chinese entities. It's really remarkable, and I think it's a testimony that there are good people hidden somewhere in the State Department, and they got a voice and they spoke up. And so, literally, if American companies are doing business with and participating in these atrocities, the State Department warned them that they're in violation of American law.
Yeah, this is stunning, and I hope the admonition to these businesses that they are highly likely, I think was the term used, to violate U.S. laws, will cause their risk management teams to think better of persisting in such businesses. Kevin, talk quickly, if you would, about how people can operationalize this principle Ben Carson was talking about, and select a financial advisor, ensure that their financial advisor is respecting their values and their desires not to, well, among other things, enable our enemies with their money.
Well, in fact, given what the State Department stated, if an American company is violating law or highly likely to be violating law by working with these Chinese entities, that puts that company at risk from lawsuit, and the shareholders can sue. You're putting our company at risk by doing this, violating the law. One of the ways to learn about all of this and what we do with Economic War Room is we train financial advisors, because the average person does not want to take the time to go and look at all of the companies and all of the research and everything else. That takes a professional to do that. And the problem is the professionals have never thought in these terms. They've always thought in terms of profit and loss, assets and credits and debits and that sort of thing. This is new thinking. That's why we started the NSIC Institute. That's why we're training at Liberty University financial advisors. If you have a financial advisor and you don't want your investments caught in this web of hurting America or doing bad things with human organ harvesting or genocide or those things, you absolutely should demand that your advisor go get this training, and they can learn more at economicwarroom.com or NSIC.org.
Fabulous. I cannot recommend highly enough the work that you're about with this National Security Investment Consultants Institute. I'm so proud of what you're doing, Kevin Freeman, and so appreciative of Liberty University and former Congressman Dave Bratt, who is the dean of the business school there, who's helping bring this vision of yours to pass at a very high level and you know, making it possible through online learning to investment advisors here as well as all over the world, for that matter. I wish you the best on that. Kevin, let me switch gears a little bit. One of the things that your investment advisor ought to also be alive to is the folly of environment, social justice, and governance prioritized investments. Larry Fink, master of the universe on Wall Street of epic proportions, some $8 trillion under management in his firm called BlackRock, is a prime mover behind this agenda. Remind us, Kevin, what the problem is with it, and talk about remarks that you made on this subject at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Dallas last week.
Well, first, BlackRock just reported earnings, and they now have $9.4 trillion under management. It's frightening how rapidly that's increased. The ESG, Environment, Social, Governance, really stands for eliminate fossil fuels, and that is the purpose of it. It's very well stated. Social justice / critical race is the S, and the G stands for gender and racial quotas. They're telling corporate boards you have to have so many women and so many of background or LGBTQ members on your board. That's what they do. That's who they are.
Without regard for the merits of their abilities or performance, they just are being selected because they fit some identity politics quota.
That's exactly right. It is. You have to have this. And these are not in regard to what's the best return for shareholders. And they publicly have said, we're not worried about the shareholders. We're worried about the stakeholders. And they list all the stakeholders. And when you step back from that, you realize it's a Marxist agenda from, we'll take from the owners and we will give to the stakeholders, which is everyone in society. It is clearly a Marxist agenda. And there are varying degrees of it. And some companies just pretend they're ESG and others are full blown in it. But if you go to the core of it, it is socialism on its way to complete Marxism, cultural Marxism and economic Marxism. And we give an alternative. It's LSV, Liberty, Security, and Values. And what I shared at CPAC was that over the past decade or so, $14 trillion has been removed as available investment to the fossil fuels industry. So there's $14 trillion less investment. So we're going to end up with higher gas prices, higher energy prices, and most of the oil and energy production will be done overseas where they're state-run enterprises with less environmental concerns. It'll be much higher environmental problems. They are concerned less about protecting the environment, and therefore the environmental risks will be greater. The Americans will lose out on this doubly because we won't get good investments, and at the same time, we'll be paying higher energy prices. It is a wealth transfer from America to the rest of the world, and that's what I shared at CPAC.
The wealth transfer is another form, of course, of Marxism, isn't it? Whether it's to the proletariat, as they say, in the country in question, or whether it's redistributing it to other nations around the world in the service of the Marxists' desire to control all of them, all of these nations. And it's a frightening prospect indeed. And I, again, appreciate so much, Kevin, your understanding of how the Marxists are using economic warfare techniques against us to advance this objective, some of which at least is financed by us. And Kevin, you were talking about these board members and so on. One of the things that's really stuck with me, I think we've touched on it before, but it bears repeating. Some of these board individuals now on the board of directors of ExxonMobil, I think three of them to be exact, are rabidly opposed to fossil fuels. I mean, it's the Green New Deal agenda. And not only are they not qualified to actually lead a company of this importance, but they're so hostile to its business model. And in so doing, so I think diabolically detrimental to our energy security in this country, that it is shocking in the extreme, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And that was made possible because of the ESG movement and the fact that people put their money in index funds and they don't vote their proxies, and they don't have an advisor helping them to weaponize their money. So in other words, it's our money voting these people in who are going to destroy the business that we own.
And the country that we love to boot. And it's made the more egregious, of course, as again, we've discussed in the past, but also warrants a reprise. Kevin Freeman, Larry Fink, the last time I checked, does not seem to have any difficulty with the lack of environmental stewardship, social justice in any reasonable meaning of the word, or governance that translates into transparency and accountability and reliability when it comes to China, in which he is now massively investing, again, our money and others. It's just stunning. It's not enough to say it's hypocritical. It is a betrayal, it seems to me, of all those folks who think that he's a godhead because he's trying to work their favorite woke agenda of ESG.
Yeah, and it has short-term payoffs and long-term consequences, and that's what America's facing unless we wake up to the reality that our money is being weaponized against us. It's time to take it back and use it as a weapon to preserve, protect, and defend our culture and pass it to the next generation.
Wake up, not woke, I guess is the bottom line. And Kevin, that next generation pit reminds me of something I meant to mention earlier in connection with your program with Ben Carson about Dunkirk. I know you've studied closely the miracle that was entailed there. And it certainly is the case that at this point, with everything that's going wrong, thanks largely, not exclusively, but largely to the Biden team and its malfeasance, we may need a miracle to rescue our country now. So I think it's entirely apt that you're drawing on this historical experience, and I pray that the good Lord has another miracle in him for us this moment.
Yeah, can I share? Nigel Farage came in the economic war room, and he shared the miracle of Brexit. He was very optimistic. Brexit was a miracle. It was an impossibility for that to pass. And once passed, it was an impossibility to implement. But they did it, and Nigel came in, he's in our current program, and shared that miracle story. So it was encouraging. It's hopeful. We can win this. If we pray, start, and do the six steps, and the last sixth step is expect a miracle.
Well, and I think that the miracle that was precipitated by the miracle of Brexit was the miracle of Donald Trump's presidency. And that brings us to, again, the need for another miracle now. And I think you're absolutely right to be both praying for it and leading us in the direction that might make it possible. Bless you, my friend. It's great to talk with you. Come back to us again next week. And until then, stay well. Keep up the terrific work you do at the Economic War Room. Check it out at economicwarroom.com. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Victoria Coates about, Donald Rumsfeld and what is afoot at the moment with Marxism in our country and beyond. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Like millions of Americans, I've become a huge fan of Tucker Carlson, his truth-telling monologues and conversations with courageous guests who do the same. Keep hope alive like the U.S.-sponsored Dissidents and Defectors Cold War broadcast Behind the Iron Curtain. Tucker posted yesterday on his extraordinary new Fox Nation program what I consider to be the most important interview by anyone in memory. I confess to being less than objective as it featured an extremely intimate and deeply moving chat with my cherished friend, John Voight. For an hour, the Oscar-winning actor described an interaction with God that changed his life, an act of humanity that he credits with transforming his career, and the imperative of telling the truth about the enemies, foreign and domestic, seeking the destruction of our country. Please watch and widely share John Voight at foxnation.com. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. Her name is Dr. Victoria Coates. She has served our country with distinction in a variety of capacities, notably as National Security Advisor to Senator Ted Cruz and as Deputy National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. These days, I'm proud to say she is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and the new director of a very exciting initiative on the Middle East and North Africa, which he will be, I believe, turning into a very important force for good in a very difficult part of the world at a very momentous time. Dr. Coates, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, it's always good to be with you.
You recently wrote a very moving tribute to a man you worked closely with and who I have admired for decades. His name was Donald Rumsfeld. National Review published it, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk with our audience about the man, his record, and the known and unknown, which you helped him translate into a memorable memoir.
Well, thank you, Frank. Obviously, Rumsfeld was one of the towering figures of the 20th and then into the 21st century in American politics and history, and remained very little understood, despite being so famous and consequential. And, you know, he was also, for me personally, as I say in the National Review piece, a transformational figure. He was the person who he used to call me an art historian of all things. I don't know what he saw, but he
well, you just happened to be a decorated art historian, but he didn't hold it against you, which is the important thing.
No, but he was very conscious of history, and so, you know, when he went to write his memoir, he didn't want to write it what he would call a kiss and tell Washington book, and he really wanted it to be substantive. So he wanted an academic who could go through his archives and help him support the claims or the recollections he had in the book. And that's what really sets Known and Unknown, I think, apart from most Washington books, is the readers can go to the website, rumsfeld.com, and see the primary documents. And he released additional tranches of them. So he wasn't cherry picking the documents. And I think the plan eventually will be to release the whole thing. And so it really is a transformational work. And he was an extraordinary person. And the article is just about the six historical moments that he had a very personal interaction with. So hopefully when folks read it, they can get a sense of the history of the time and then the man who really shaped it.
Well, let's talk about those six, but I do want to just make sure our audience recalls that while Donald Rumsfeld was, I fear, probably best remembered or worst remembered, as the case may be, for his time as George W. Bush's first Secretary of Defense in the hard days that followed 9/11 and the two wars that ensued. He had actually been in that role previously as the youngest Secretary of Defense during Gerald Ford's administration. He'd served as the White House Chief of Staff. He'd served as a congressman. He had been a very successful business leader. He was a naval aviator, a wrestler, a man of many parts. And I think you capture that very nicely in this National Review article, and I really do commend it to all of our listeners. But just for those who may or may not get to it, can you just pick out one or two of those six that are particularly important to understand?
Sure. And I guess I would also add husband and father. I mean, he and Joyce married the year he graduated from Princeton, and Marcy and Val and Nick, their three wonderful children, were, you know, the centerpieces of his life. I think for me, the most surprising of the moments was Man on the Moon. You mentioned he was a naval aviator. He actually considered becoming an astronaut in the first class of astronauts. He was fascinated by space, did a great deal of work on it throughout his career, culminating in the commission, the Clinton-era commission on national security and space, because he wouldn't talk about Man on the Moon. And I kept thinking, this has got to be one of the great moments, you know, of your early career. And we had adjoining cubicles. I talked to him all the time, but he wouldn't talk about it. I finally scheduled time. He dragged him into the conference room. And he just looked at me and said, I didn't want to do it. He's like, I thought it was a waste. I wanted to control the 150 miles around the Earth. I thought, you know, if we could, I mean, he talked about it as literally the 51st state. If we had control of that, we could ensure it was developed property. And it wasn't, you know, a Kennedy-esque man on the moon, you know, exciting thing. But if you think about it, if we had done that, the kind of control we would have now and the kind of security we would have now. And I think the other one for what's in the news this week with the Iranian kidnapping plot was when George Shultz called in the day after the Beirut bombing and asked him to become Reagan's Middle East envoy was when he really started to grapple with the issue of terrorism, and particularly state-sponsored terrorism. And he wrote a great deal about it, worked on it, and was enormously concerned about it. And, you know, you also mentioned that Bush-era tenure as SecDef. I think what folks need to understand, particularly as we approach the 20th anniversary of 9/11, is that, you know, he understood his role as the head of the Pentagon to execute a military strike. And both the strikes on Afghanistan and Iraq were enormously, maybe too successful. We have a wonderful military. They did what they were asked to do. And he wanted to declare victory and come home. He had no, I mean, people fault him for not being, you know, sufficiently interested in nation building. Well, we can see where that gets us. Now, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight.
And sadly, he's been saddled with being responsible for the nation building that was not very successful when, as you say, it was not his idea or his plan or his desire, but that was what was dealt him. And I'm sorry that it has tended to overshadow, at least for the short of memory, the extraordinary accomplishments of this man over so many years. And I commend you for your time with him and your service in helping really translate his life experiences, not least his lessons, as he calls them, Rumsfeld's rules, that are really words to live by. Let me switch gears, if I can, quickly, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, Dr. Coates. This coming week is the annual celebration or recognition or mourning, pick your verb, of the phenomenon of captive nations. And this is a term, of course, that you, as an historian, remember very well from the Cold War. It was applied to the nations that had been enslaved by Soviet communism. And today, I think it applies nicely to states that have been enslaved by Chinese communism, East Turkestan, the so-called Xinjiang area, where the Uyghurs are being genocidally persecuted, and Tibet, where all kinds of horrors have been inflicted for decades, and southern Mongolia, similarly, now subjected to a kind of cultural genocide, and then, of course, Hong Kong, the recent addition that is watching as we speak, you know, its lifeblood of freedom dissipating. Tell us what we should take away from the fact that, as I understand it, the Biden administration is actively considering not issuing, for the first time since 1959, under presidents of both parties and all political stripes, a proclamation recognizing the captive nations and seeking to stand with them.
Yeah, it's remarkable. As I understand it, they're considering sort of rebranding this as Free and Open Societies Week, and I'm sure they will again issue an invitation to the United Nations to come to the U.S. and tell us all about our sins and why we're not free and open, while they refrain from criticizing, right?
Even as they're crushing our freedoms, I have to say, every day.
But this is very true. You know, as if, you know, Captive Nations Week is some sort of quaint relic of the Cold War. And I think the inconvenient truth for them is just because we won the Cold War, and obviously you were a great participant in that victory, and it was a highlight for our nation. But just because we won the Cold War doesn't mean totalitarian communism went away. And the events we've seen this week in Cuba, I think, are a grim reminder that even the aftermath of Soviet communism is still with us in our own hemisphere, you know, not 100 miles off our shores. And as you raised, you know, the East Turkestan issue, all of the very, very grim activities of the communist Chinese, which are, I think, our generational challenge now. This is the next big challenge for the United States. And to just arbitrarily give up this tool that we have used, as you say, for generations to express the condemnation of the United States for, you know, for this kind of oppression, and celebrate the freedoms. I mean, there's a reason the people in Cuba are waving the American flag. You know, we stand for freedom, and why you would just give that up. You just cede the moral high ground to the communist Chinese is just mind-boggling to me.
Well, it may have something to do with the fact that we've populated, under the Biden administration, most of the senior ranks of the U.S. government, certainly those that touch on the China portfolio in any way, with people who are, well, compromised from the president on down by the Chinese Communist Party. But it's no less unacceptable or shocking what's being done here. And I hope that it will be resisted, and hope in particular that your wonderful former boss, Senator Ted Cruz, a keeper of the flame of the Center for Security Policy, will be one of those vociferously opposing this idea and expressing his own solidarity with the captive nations. You mentioned Cuba. He understands a lot about what these countries are suffering. Which brings me very quickly, Victoria, to Peru. There's a nation very important in Latin America. I happen to have a family connection to it because of my wife's coming from it. But we're watching now another election, it seems, being stolen using fraud. A very narrow victory is being accorded, I fear, to a Marxist with ties to the Shining Path, no less, a terrorist organization there, that will, unfortunately, I'm afraid, send Peru hurtling down the tracks that Venezuela has gone, among others in that region. Just your quick thoughts on that, Victoria, what we should make of it and what we should do about it.
It's an enormous concern, Frank. And, you know, the administration seems very, very lightly staffed on Latin and South America, which is a huge problem. We've seen it in Cuba. We have it in Nicaragua. You mentioned Venezuela. Now, Peru, we cannot allow this. Haiti, you know, we cannot allow our own hemisphere to drift. And we know our enemies are looking at it, I'm sure.
Everyone looking at it, they're all over it, yeah, unfortunately.
They're
there. Is a problem? They're not only observing, they are actively bringing this to pass. Well, again, I don't want to impose upon you unduly, but this is a mission for Ted Cruz, if ever there were one. If we can stave off a theft of freedom from the people of Peru and not watch it catalyze, unfortunately, I fear similar kinds of outrages elsewhere. Countries that have not yet been enslaved, not yet captive nations. It would be a tremendous victory.
Exactly. I would just add, if I could really quickly, I mean, President Monroe had it right. You know, we have a vested national interest in Central and South America, and we have to defend it.
Amen. We're going to talk more about all of this with John Suarez momentarily with the Committee for Free Cuba. But Victoria Coates, we have to let you go. I know. Thank you very much for your time today. Congratulations once again on the new MENA program, Middle East and North Africa program at the Center for Security Policy. And thanks again for your support for Don Rumsfeld and for paying tribute to him here at Secure Freedom Radio. We're delighted to have you do so. God bless. Next up, John Suarez, right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com. We'll be right back.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined by John Suarez, who is the executive director of a terrific organization, the Center for a Free Cuba. He previously served in the area of Latin America programs at another very important organization, Freedom House. He is a prolific contributor to the public policy debate about, well, Marxism in places like Cuba and the imperative need to prevent its continuation, let alone its expansion. And I'm very pleased of being able to catch up with him to talk particularly about a subject that we touched on with Victoria Coates a moment ago, namely what's going on in Cuba, the promise and the prospects of real change there. And John, thank you very much for taking some time to talk to us here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. It's an honor.
So let me just put the question to you, if I may. We're seeing remarkable evidence of popular discontent with the Cuban regime. I'm so appreciative that any of these people are actually standing up courageously to the vast forces of tyranny and oppression that the Cuban government can bring to bear against them. Tell us about how that's going and whether it's continuing and spreading.
What's happened is, as you know, on Sunday, July 11th, Cubans across the island, tens of thousands, took to the streets in protest. The triggering mechanism was in southeast of Havana, in a place called, in an area called Los Baños. There was a huge initial outpouring of people. It got out over social media. It was seen across the island, and that inspired folks in over 50 towns and cities to take to the streets. Now, the reason for this is that, one, there have the liberal media who had you believe that this is something rare that never happens, but there have been a number of protests taking place and escalating over the past year. The difference this time is that it spread across the island in such impressive. The closest thing that we could see to something like this before was on August 5th of 1994, the Maliconazo, when thousands of people took to the streets in Havana. But back then, they did not have social media and cell phones to have that, create that chain reaction nationwide. The regime's response was to get out their anti-riot troops, their shock troops, with weapons, machine guns, 2x4s, baseball bats, and go out into the streets and violently repress the demonstrators. And that is something.
And they were actually exhorted to do that by the current president.
They were ordered to do it by Mr. Diaz-Canel, who gave an address saying that this was a moment of combat, a moment to take to the streets, and that there would not be any sort of change in Cuba over his dead body, and they would do anything they'd have to do to stop it.
Yeah, this was a lot of other people's dead bodies, specifically. Right?
Exactly.
So now, how has this been playing out? I mean, has this actually quelled the demonstrations, the violence been used?
The demonstrations have continued. However, the other thing they did immediately was to shut off the internet, and the ability to show images through your cell phones. And in many cases, they shut off the cell phones. They rounded up hundreds of opposition activists and thousands of people. Some estimates, which I imagine are conservative, Yanni Sanchez had the number of 5,000 that have been arrested, but it's probably much more. The information has been coming out in drips and drabs since they shut down the internet and access to it. But people have found ways through different apps to get some information out, and the images are quite compelling. People who have been brutally beaten, people have been killed. The regime admitted that one person was killed, but it's probably in the hundreds based on conversations I've had with folks in the country. But despite that, people are still out in the street.
God bless them. And I hope that their numbers are actually increasing. So that brings me to the next question, John Suarez, and that is, what can the United States do to support and empower the people of Cuba to join the opposition in overt ways. And is any of that being actually done by the Biden administration at the moment?
Well, I mean, we saw the Biden administration, President Biden came out with a statement that was a good start, but not enough. Secretary of State Blinken
took him a long time to get it out, too, as I recall.
It did take a bit of time.
Grudging and rather inadequate overall. Go ahead.
But compared to what we had under the Obama administration, at least it got things right. It didn't confuse the dictatorship with the Cuban people and recognize their right to protest, and that was something positive. However, as you say,
he hasn't vacationed in Cuba yet, as former President Obama did.
Exactly. Now, the critical issue is that more needs to be said. There needs to, more needs to be done. Radio Martí needs to be put on full blast into the island. It needs to be fully funded. They need to be collecting the names of the repressors and putting sanctions on them, Magnitsky sanctions. They need to be, the U.S. also would be very helpful to let, you know, Russia, China, and Iran have been threatening that the U.S. should not get involved in Cuba. Well, I think the United States should be advising Russia, China, and Iran to get out of Cuba and not to involve themselves in the internal situation there between the Cubans seeking freedom and the Cuban dictatorship. I think, furthermore, that the other thing that's very important is for the United States since the Biden administration purports that multilateral institutions are so important, they need to be pushing at the Organization of American States, at the UN, to bring up and pass resolutions recognizing what's going on and demanding support for the Cuban demonstrators. They should also be lobbying and negotiating diplomatically with the European Union, that also has had a very tardy role in its condemnations and with its foreign service often complicit in legitimizing the dictatorship and recognizes a one-party democracy. There needs to be a focus on the need for political change, for democratic change in Cuba, and highlighting the incompetence of the regime that has led, the incompetence and also the evil of this regime that has led to this outcome.
All good ideas, and I pray that they will be embraced by this administration. It's striking to me that a resolution sort of along these general lines has been introduced in the Congress, and not a single Democrat has signed up as a co-sponsor of it to date. Does that surprise you?
It does a bit. I mean, there are Democrats like Abby Ocides out of New Jersey, obviously the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S. Senate, Senator Robert Menendez, and I think will be supporting such a statement based on their past actions. And I'm sure there are others that should come on board. The question is, why is it taking it so long?
Well, and why are they not at the forefront of this, actually, especially given their constituencies? Let me turn to a related subject, if I can, John, quickly. Cuba, of course, has not only been saddled with this horrific regime for decades, back to 1959, but it has exported its military personnel, its doctors, and its economic model to other countries in our hemisphere with, I think it's fair to say, unbroken, disastrous effects. And one of the things that I am particularly concerned about, again, we talked about it a little bit a moment ago with Victoria Coates, is a critically important nation in South America, Peru, which is perilously close to having a Cuban-aligned Marxist with ties to the Shining Path terrorist organization, no less, a man by the name of Pedro Castillo, become the president of that country with an agenda that is unmistakably, it seems, on track to make that very promising nation, a nation with free and enterprising people and tremendous resources and the like, the next Venezuela. Your thoughts, especially given that, you know, Cubans are going to be in that mix, to be sure, along with Chinese and Russians and Iranians and Hezbollah and who knows who all else.
Well, I think it's always important to remember that the Castro regime, from its inception in 1959, had designs on turning the Andes of South America into the Sierra Maestra of South America. And they immediately set out to try to overthrow neighboring governments in 1959 and throughout the 1960s, send armed guerrillas into Venezuela, Nicaragua, and elsewhere to overthrow those governments. And in the case of Nicaragua, succeeded in 1979. They failed in other countries, but then they shifted from guerrilla struggles to the ballot box with Hugo Chavez, and were successful in 98, 99. And of course, what we've seen is once these regimes get into power, either by the gun, as the case of Nicaragua with Daniel Ortega, it's very difficult to get rid of them. And also by the ballot box, as we've seen with Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro, the first election was legitimate. After that, when the structures are taken over, the ability to have free and fair elections are compromised. The Cuban intelligence apparatus and the Cuban military there are sent to transform the military and intelligence and security of the country, and
providing, among other things, the political commissars to ensure, you know, control of those assets of the state and their use in enforcing this totalitarian system over time. And you're so right. I mean, this is vividly on display, of course, in Venezuela, where I'm pretty sure that were it not for those kinds of forces on the ground, Cuban military personnel and Cuban intelligence, the Maduro regime would have fallen long ago, don't you think?
I think so. And the Castro Institute, based out of the Czech Republic, has done, Tamara Sužu, who's the executive director there, has done some incredible work in cataloging the presence of Cuban intelligence, the Cuban military, their role in torture and rape of Venezuelan activists in the country. So it is the behavior of the Cubans is frankly criminal. And we can expect, yes, and we can expect that with a regime linked to the Shining Path backed by Havana in Peru, that you'll see a similar pattern play out. Now, I think that Peruvian citizens, having seen what's happened in Venezuela and having seen what's happened in Nicaragua, hopefully there'll be a critical mass that will be trying. And we saw the election in Peru was very tight. So one hopes.
And fraud race, I believe, yes, as well.
Yes, but one hopes that they will be fully engaged and doing everything to resist the duplication of this Venezuelan model there. But it will be an incredible challenge.
It will. And all the more reason, to your point, when you look at how difficult, if not virtually impossible, it is to free these countries, liberate them from cruelty and oppression of these Marxists. And this is not to take anything away from the people in Cuba trying to do just that now. And as we talked about, we ought to be doing everything we can to empower and enable their success. But it is very hard. And for that reason, especially, it seems to me, we ought to be doing everything we can as a nation and through, you know, alliance relationships and through the OAS and any other means of influencing things specifically, to assure that there is a fair and accurate accounting of the votes in Peru that would hopefully stave off what is otherwise, I'm afraid, about to befall those folks. And by the way, as we've talked about, John, with others on this show, should that happen, much as we've seen over the years large numbers of Cubans fleeing their homeland, we will almost certainly see unleashed upon a region that frankly can't accommodate a whole lot more refugees, and people will inexorably be driven here from Peru, from Colombia perhaps, from Chile, from perhaps other countries that will, like dominoes, I'm afraid, be affected by this disaster in Peru.
As we're seeing now with the Venezuelan exodus and the Nicaraguan exodus from their respective countries with the repressions taking place. I just want to conclude by highlighting also the importance that in this ongoing debate, there are many folks that either through ignorance or through bad intention have confused the fundamental problem that's taking place in Cuba and what provoked these protests. The regime and some of their allies are blaming U.S. economic sanctions. The reality is that over the last 2 years, the Castro regime, and I call it the Castro regime, he reappeared, Raul Castro, earlier this week. Díaz-Canel is a puppet. Raul Castro and the Castro dynasty still run the country with López Calleja, the general who manages the conglomerate Gaesa and runs 80% of the Cuban economy, is also in the Politburo. They have been seeking the elimination of the black market in Cuba. There were mules who would go from Dominican Republic, the Bahamas, Mexico, Panama, with food, medicines that they purchased abroad and would sell in Cuba. The Cuban regime is involved in drug trafficking and they have their relationship with the Solis cartel. But what I'm talking about here is actually how people inside the island were getting fed with these mules, and also the United States. The Castro regime has been purchasing agricultural products in the United States for decades. The U.S. in the last year of the Bush administration, $711 million worth of agricultural products went to Cuba. One of the stories just came out recently showed, however, that Cuba, the Castro regime, purchases chicken, for example, from Arkansas at $1 per kilo. They turn around and sell it to Cubans at $7 per kilo. And this is with folks that have a salary of about $800 per month.
It's a starvation diet, and that's obviously contributing to the protests.
That is the reason people out in the street, because they know it. They also know that they shut down the travel of these mules because they didn't want to have the competition, citing COVID, but they left the travel from places like Russia and India, where things were far worse, because those tourists coming in were going into the military-run hotels and providing hard currency to that military that is in Venezuela, in Nicaragua, hurting and killing people today, and also shooting Cubans today who are out in the streets of Havana.
Thank you very much, Mr. This is a tremendously important report. Thank you for joining us. I know you've got to go, and we appreciate your time today. I hope you'll come back to us again soon, and the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.